Growing up, Alexandria Spriggins always knew she'd go to college.
It was always just expected that I would go to college, just like you go from elementary school to middle school and middle school to high school. College was logically the next step.
She graduated from high school in 2012 and decided to attend Loyola University, New Orleans. Spriggins received a partial scholarship, but it didn't cover everything. She still had to find $25,000 to meet tuition costs. So Spriggins did what millions of Americans do. She took a loan.
My dad was super skeptical about it, and he definitely gave me an ultimatum. Like, you know, we can take out this loan, but it's 100% going to be your responsibility to pay back. And he tried to, you know, let me know what a loan actually was. But being 18 at the time, I was just like, you know, whatever will get me into school, I'll do it.
So with her parents' help, Spriggins took on the loan and headed to Loyola in the fall. But after her freshman year...
So I was preparing to, you know, enroll in my fall 2013 classes. And I logged into like the student portal, and there was this huge balance that was unpaid. And it was the gap between what wasn't covered by scholarships and what was supposed to be covered by loans.
See, Spriggins hadn't realized that her loans only covered her differences for the fall semester. They were never approved for the spring. So if she couldn't pay off the balance, she could not go back to school. Her parents couldn't help her with another loan, so she dropped out.
It was scary for a long time. It was disheartening for a long time. It was, yeah, I kind of fell into a depression, you know, after that.
The debt followed her. Her transcripts remained sealed, so she couldn't enroll in a community college. And she also received daily reminders from her lenders.
Sallie Mae did, you know, call me every single day of my life, even weekends, multiple times a day for, you know, from 2014 all the way up until 2017 when I finally just changed my phone number.
It took years, but Alexandria Spriggins says she did get her life back on track. She took online courses in web development, and in 2017, she landed an opportunity that led to a full-time job. That student loan debt, though, is still with her, as is the wreckage of her credit score. Now, Spriggins, of course, is just one of the approximately 43 million adult Americans who currently carry a federal student loan. Collectively, they owe more than $1.5 trillion in federal student loan debt.
Not only can I not get a business loan, my husband and I cannot get a mortgage. I can't even get a credit card right now.
It affects what things you can do for your kids. It affects the ability to save for your kids' college. You know, we certainly don't go on any vacations, anything like that.
My wife and I have actually had conversations about foregoing purchasing homes or having a family because of student loan debt.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. So, look, I'll just say it. It might feel obvious why there's a renewed push for the federal government to forgive these masses of student loan debt. It would change millions of lives. You heard the voices of just a couple of those Americans. But is it the right thing to do? There are also millions of Americans who chose an education within their means or who didn't go to college. So is forgiving the debt of others fair to them? There's the old moral hazard issue as well. And here's the thing I really want to know. Does debt forgiveness do anything at all to change the underlying problem in this country, the super high cost of higher education? So that is what we're going to dive into this hour. And we're joined today by Professor Naomi Zodi. She's an assistant professor at City University of New York's School of Public Health. She teaches about health economics and conducts wide-ranging research on economics and insurance reform, amongst others. Professor Zodi, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
So first of all, you heard those voices from just a few people who are feeling the weight, that anchor of student loan debt really dragging their lives or dragging down their lives. Can you describe to me a little in a little bit more detail sort of how that $1.5 trillion of federal debt is really having an impact on the lives of Americans?
Yeah, those were really incredible stories. And you're right, it's being multiplied tens of millions of times over. You know, the average monthly student loan payment is about $400. Half of people spend more than $200 a month on their student loan payment. So every single month, and this is money that is in fact owed to the federal government, to the Department of Education. So every single month, people are paying hundreds of dollars out of their bank accounts to the federal government. And for many people, and it's disproportionately true for Black borrowers, but for many people, the balance on their loan is actually growing every year, even as they're making these payments, because even with hundreds of dollars a month, it's not always enough to cover the accruing interest. Mm. So that's money that's being taken away from everything else that they try to do in life. And one of the things that, you know, the first person brought up about being so young when they make this financial decision that will follow them for the rest of their lives, I think it's important to like acknowledge that fact that, you know, when they're making this decision, these are people who are in high school, probably living with their parents, and they don't really know what their future income is going to be or their future expenses. They've never really had to budget. So it's hard to understand what a couple of hundred dollars a month means.
Right.
Well, in disposable income.
In Alexandria's case, she did say that her parents warned her, like, this is a loan. There's some serious things to it. But, you know, as you said, she was 18 and was like, whatever. But that whole whatever is worth a conversation, too. We'll talk about that in a second. I wanted to just fact check one thing with you, Professor. Mm-hmm. The CARES Act put a lot of these student loans in forbearance. Is that not correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Okay. So they're not taking money from anybody, I think, through the end of this year.
Okay. So just wanted, like, there's been a sort of pandemically induced pause on that student loan. Not that we wanted a pandemic to bring about the pause, but just in case people are wondering what's happening right now at this second. Now, you mentioned the disproportionate impact on Black borrowers and Latino borrowers. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? How much more, on average, are Black and Latino Americans taking or having to take it on in student loans?
Yeah. So, and by the way, so that pause is only through the end of this year, which I believe just means December. So in January, they, unless Congress makes some other move, they'll resume on collecting those debts. But it does have disproportionate effects on Black and Latinx households. And it makes sense if you think about it, because, you know, overall, the median Black household has $16,000 of net worth as of 2016. And that's inclusive of home equity. And the median white household has over $160,000 in home equity. So the fact is, without kind of generational wealth, it's going to be a lot harder for your parents to pay your tuition. I mean, tuition costs more than $16,000. So what ends up happening is that Black and Latinx people take out more in loans on average. And, you know, maybe like 20,000, 25,000 on average, more in debt that is held by Black borrowers 4 years after graduation. And almost half of Black borrowers owe more 4 years after graduation than they took out initially. Whereas it's under 20% of white borrowers who owe more 4 years after than they had taken out. Because, you know, so part of it is about differences in how much debt they have to take on. And then there's also the fact that once you get the degree, how the labor market is going to treat that degree will differ based on your race.
Mm-hmm. So let's get right to it then. There's obviously energy amongst leading Democrats for some kind of student loan debt forgiveness. I'd like to start with Blue Sky. Okay, Professor Zodi, so what would be your ideal debt forgiveness proposal right now?
Well, so the thing that would be best for borrowers would be just to get rid of it all. just cancel it all. And not just the federal debt, obviously the federal debt. I think the federal government has no business collecting this money from households. But even the privately held debts, I think the Fed can buy them off, like the toxic assets of the financial crisis. Really, we have the capacity, even without Congress, to just get rid of it all.
Just get rid of it all. Okay. And yeah. But is that one of, I mean, is that a, does that have legs in Washington now? Will it after January?
It does. I mean, the fact that we're talking about canceling any of this is really a testament to just people and how much they've been voicing this need. So, you know, I mean, it's entirely within like the authority of just the president individually. So it wouldn't take that much lobbying to get it done.
Okay, so let's hear briefly what President-elect Joe Biden has said about the idea of forgiving federal student loans.
It does figure in my plan. I've laid out in detail, for example, the legislation passed by the Democratic House calls for immediate $10,000 forgiveness of student loans. It's holding people up. They're in real trouble. They're having to make choices between paying their student loan and paying their rent, those kinds of decisions. It should be done immediately.
So, Professor Zodi, the president-elect there pointing to a $10,000 forgiveness in student loans. That's not a complete cancellation by any means, but would that be effective?
It would be. It would be a good place. I mean, it's a good thing to do regardless. I think about half of borrowers who are in default or have been at some point in default would have their entire loan balances erased if by forgiving 10,000 or canceling 10,000 in debts. But I really think that the problem is bigger than a $10 cancellation really gets at. You know, if you think about since 2006, the total aggregate student loan balance has ballooned, like tripled. Mm. So it's kind of a structural scale problem.
Right, exactly. And so getting at those structural aspects of this challenge is what we want to do this hour. So Professor Zodi, stand by here for just a moment. We're exploring the ideas and the debate when it comes to canceling student loans. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we are exploring the ideas and the debate over forgiving student loan debt in the United States. A little earlier, you heard the voices from some On Point listeners telling us the impact that carrying student loan debt has had on their lives. We also heard from some listeners who did not support the idea of widespread loan forgiveness.
I will lose my mind if they do that student loan forgiveness. When I went to college, I chose a college that was a state school because that was what I could afford. I worked four jobs while I was in college so that I didn't have any debt. When you take out, you know what you're signing for. And it's a choice. Life's all about choices.
I'm not for it. You know, I guess I was lucky in that I had a family who raised me to be wary of debt. Ultimately, I ended up joining the military so I could pay for college. I just don't see where the equity is in there.
So those are some On Point listeners from West Virginia and from New York. Professor Zodi, when we say equity, right? I mean, Nathan, the caller there, used that very word. It's being used in different contexts, right? Like just in the previous segment, we talked about how, you know, the disproportionate impact of student loans on Black students, for example. There's a kind of trying to achieve equity there as well. But I want to just get straight to what does fairness mean here? Because I think you probably remember from the presidential primaries last year, oh my God, it might as well be 500 years ago, but it was last year, there was a moment where I think it was in Iowa where an Iowa voter confronted Senator Elizabeth Warren about this idea of student loan debt forgiveness. And the voter was saying like, hey, his daughter's getting out of school. He saved all his money and even worked multiple jobs so that she didn't have to have any student loans. So, you know, would he get that money back? And Senator Warren said no. And it just infuriated him because he made the decisions to not give his daughter a legacy of debt. And there would be no payoff for that, or no other people who chose the debt path would have it forgiven. So what do you think about that fairness question?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question. I mean, so does fairness in this instance, let's say we don't cancel any of the debt, he's still not going to get that money back, but it might prevent, you know, the next generation of people from having to work multiple jobs and do all of this extra work to get their children educated. So failing to cancel anyone's debt doesn't really solve problems here, you know.
Doesn't solve problems in terms of like the underlying cost of higher ed.
Correct, and also then the same thing will just continue to happen. Is it fair to that guy that everyone else must suffer in the same way?
Okay, well, so but I mean, failing to cancel debt doesn't solve that problem. But how does canceling the debt solve the problem of very expensive higher education in this country?
I think that it has to go hand in hand with policies that address that exact problem. The fact that that college tuition year over year has increased far beyond inflation. And there are just like structural issues at universities. I think that a lot of these universities, you know, they've had to invest so heavily in responding to the coronavirus, and they are out of resources, and local and state governments are also low on resources. So it's likely the federal government is going to have to invest in these institutions of higher education. So it seems like a good opportunity to deal with that underlying problem at the same time as addressing what we've been doing for the past several decades.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the fact that
No. I didn't mean to interrupt you there, but I'm agreeing. Like this to me is the core issue. Cancellation or no cancellation is a short term decision with impact on 43 million Americans right now. But does it, you know, you were talking about next generations. It doesn't do really anything to obviate the problem for them. There's one more question I wanted to just ask you about fairness, and feel free to tell me that this is a terrible comparison. But, you know, every single day, I mean, especially after the financial crisis, Americans, or the housing crisis, I should say, from 08, Americans have been told, don't buy a house outside your means. Buy the house that you can afford. Why shouldn't we have the same encouragement for education?
Yeah, so that's interesting. I mean, it might be a good opportunity to contrast with what's happening in Europe. For example, in Denmark, you get 6 years of free tuition, room and board, and a stipend to attend higher education. What they're going to have is an educated people, an educated workforce, an educated citizenry. If what we're going to say instead is, if your parents are not wealthy, don't go to a good school, don't go to an expensive school. I mean, that's one way of building a society. I'm not sure that it's the best one. We know it's going to be then financially, racially, socioeconomically exclusive. And that's kind of not the idea that we have about America, right? You're supposed to be able to go to school and move up in life. Higher education is a tool for social mobility and also, and very often, just not even mobility, but just hanging on to wherever it is that you were able to achieve in the last generation, just stasis, just like being really part of society. Most jobs require a college degree these days. So I don't know that we want to tell people you can't afford to go to school, so don't.
Mm. Well, let's listen to listener Lindell Beatty, who called us and said that loan forgiveness doesn't necessarily need to cover the entire debt.
Honestly, even if the Biden administration forgave the interest that we've paid and put the money that we've paid towards our principal and then forgave the interest, a lot of us would be really far ahead.
Okay, well, so let's bring in another voice now. Beth Akers joins us. Beth is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, an economist studying higher education and labor markets, and co-author of Game of Loans, The Rhetoric and Reality of Student Debt. Beth, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Magna. Thanks for having me today.
So I'm there's kind of two problems here, right? There's the current weight of federal student loan debt, and then there's the underlying cost of higher ed. So let's stick with problem number one here for a few more minutes. Short of a total cancellation, which was the blue sky idea that Professor Zodi talked about at the beginning of the show. Of course, it's not the only idea that she's got, but it's a place to start. What are some other ways or other policies to get at this problem that wouldn't, you know, be the magic wand erasing $1.5 trillion off the books?
Right. Great question. So to start, I want to point out that we actually already have in place an infrastructure to make unaffordable loans forgivable through an income-based repayment program. And so, you know, an ideal solution would really just make that program work much better. We can talk more about why it isn't working perfectly. Something that I've proposed, though, is, you know, since there's so much political momentum behind getting some sort of forgiveness program, one-time forgiveness, I've suggested that we actually forgive a much smaller amount, $5,000, and then use that as a political chip in order to get the reform of the repayment system that would make the really progressive safety nets that are already in place work much better. The reason I think that would work well is because it would completely discharge the debts for people who are struggling the most. Surprisingly, it's people with less than $5,000 in debt who have the highest rate of default on their loans. Just like your caller earlier in the show, that's because a lot of them have started their degree but didn't finish.
So, Professor Zodi, what do you think about that? That just $5,000 upon first blush doesn't actually sound like that much, but would it reach a lot of people?
Well, among all of those who have been in default at some time, it would eliminate the debt of about one third of those people. So, of course, about 67% of the defaulters would still have debts that they'd have to pay. I mean, I think $5,000 is really the smallest possible increment that you could really make a policy in. But I don't see really the merits in kind of going the minimal route.
Beth, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah. You know, the merits is kind of like what are also the downsides of a more universal forgiveness plan. And there's a great study that just came out from two scholars at the University of Chicago who ran the numbers and basically showed that universal or even partial forgiveness would deliver as much benefit to the top 10% of earners as it does to the bottom 30% of earners. So that's a surprising statistic. But what it comes from is that people who have a lot of student loan debt also happen to have a lot of income. A lot of them have gotten graduate and professional degrees. They're doctors and lawyers. And because of that, they have the money to pay back these loans. That's why they took them in the first place. So reducing the scale of forgiveness could alleviate the debt for the people who are really struggling the most, but without taking funds away from other low-income programs to give an unnecessary transfer to the already very well-off in our economy.
So that's interesting. You know, I was just suddenly when you described that, it also brought to mind Social Security. Right? Because it doesn't matter what your income is, your retirement income is. you're still eligible to collect on Social Security because you paid into – I mean, that's because you paid into it. That's a slightly different issue here. But essentially, your advocate – is it's like kind of a student loan version of means testing?
Yeah, exactly. You know, in my perfect policy, I'd imagine we have a safety net that ensures that anybody in this country can go to college. But if it turns out that that isn't the offer for you, you're not stuck with a bill that you can't afford for the rest of your life. The existing programs that we have are essentially means tested. So they follow a borrower over 10 or 20 years, depending on which industry they're employed in. And if the amount that they pay each month is sufficiently low because they have low income and the amount they have to pay is based on their income, then they'll ultimately have their debt forgiven. And so what that does is targets the benefits to the people who, for them, the investment didn't pay off. And then the people who do pay the price for higher ed are the ones who spend that money, whether it be through debt or through their own dollars, and actually do see that return so that student loan repayment is affordable for them.
Okay. And so, Professor Zodi, what do you think about that?
So two things. One, those existing programs that we have not worked. They've just simply not worked. I think most recently they tried to do some reforms to it. And the most recent numbers are that after 10 years of working, you know, the public service loan forgiveness, it's you pay on this income-based repayment plan. You work for 10 years, you make 10 years worth of qualifying payments while working in a nonprofit or government. And then at the end of that, they're supposed to forgive the remaining balance. The problem is that 130,000 people applied after 10 years. And 120,000 of those applications were rejected for having, you know, some missing information on the form, or they were making 10 years of payments, but their payments were under the wrong administrative category, this kind of thing. So 120,000 out of 130,000 people who tried to do that program were unable to do it. So it's not, I think it's really not working at all. So we could invest a lot of time and energy and resources into trying to perfect the system by which we kind of take money from people every month, or we could just invest in education and just let people get that education.
But Professor Zodi, I actually am really glad you brought up the public service loan forgiveness program, if I'm even close to what the actual title is.
That's right.
Because it's the one that comes up over and over and over again. And you're exactly right about the minuscule fraction of people who are able to actually get their debts after their 10 years of public service forgiven. But the reasons why most people didn't succeed in that program, as you just outlined, seem to me to be administrative reasons, right? That it wasn't the program per se that was inadequate or insufficient, but it was the bureaucratic execution of it. So couldn't we just fix that?
Right. So we would have to, right now, they're all private companies that are contracted to serve as the loan servicers. And they make money based on how many people they're servicing. And it's not in their best, it's not like they're not incentivized to actually get people off of their roles. So yeah, if we could find some kind of way of incentivizing them, like giving them a percentage or a percentage of a percentage of every dollar that they save for people, you know, so that they would start working on behalf of the borrower, we could try to design some kind of program like that.
Yeah. Okay.
So, and probably moving forward, we should, whether or not we're going to forgive this debt.
Okay. So Beth Akers, let me turn back to you on that, because I think one of the problems here is that we keep saying programs, right? Like there are a lot of different programs out there and many different administrators of said programs that eventually all fall under the big umbrella of federal student loan. It seems to me ripe for inefficiencies. Is there a way to solve the big problem by simplifying that?
Absolutely. And so I think you've really hit on the crux of the issue here. What happened over the past decade is that we have slowly, through executive action, bits and pieces of legislation here and there, created what is a universal safety net, which means that anyone with a student loan is eligible to go to their servicer and have their loan payments adjusted to an affordable level based on their income. The problem is that there is not one single program that does this. And so it makes it nearly impossible for most people who don't sit around and study this stuff all day like I do to know what benefits are available to them, how to get them. What needs to happen is a reauthorization of the Higher Education Act, which is what sets in place the entire student lending program, as well as every other aspect of financial aid for higher education. If we were to do that, we could get everybody automatically enrolled in an income-based repayment program once they start repaying their loans, which would mean you wouldn't even need to know that these programs existed. So there's a lot of ways to simplify this, and I think they would go a really, really long way in making people feel more confident about student loan repayment, but also actually easing the burden for people who do need the help.
Well, Beth Akers and Professor Naomi Zodi, stand by. We are exploring and investigating ways to get a handle on the problem of student loan debt in the United States. When we come back, we'll hear a little bit about how it's done in another country, Australia, and whether the Australian example can shine a light on a great path forward for the United States. So we'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking about ideas and the debate over student loan forgiveness. And we're joined today by Professor Naomi Zodi. She's a professor or assistant professor at the City University of New York School of Public Health. Beth Akers also joins us. She's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and co-author of Game of Loans, The Rhetoric and Reality of Student Debt. Now, we wanted to take a look at a global example of how of a possibly different way of approaching the problem of student loan debt. So let's look at Australia. Some see that as a potential model for reform in the U.S.
The way the loans work is the students can take out loans for the full cost of tuition. And the loans aren't means tested. Anybody can take out a loan. And then when you leave school, your loans are repaid as a share of your income.
That's Jason Delisle, resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he works on higher ed financing. And he described how student loans and repayments work in Australia.
Now, there's sort of a complicated schedule by which the payments are calculated. It's a percentage of your income that actually increases in percentage terms as your income rises. But you pay nothing if you earn below a certain threshold. So the thought at the time was, well, no one should have to begin paying these loans until they earn above whatever the average is for people who go and get bachelor's degrees.
The at the time was 1989. Australia had had free higher education for about 15 years, but budgetary strain had limited the number of seats available for Australian students. So in order to open up seats, the country returned to charging fees for higher education.
So for the government, this is still a cost reduction and it's still a cost increase for students, but still a fairly generous loan system. But the changes over time is that Australia, particularly recently, Australia has the policymakers there have been lowering that threshold.
Now, Delisle says he believes there's a downside to the Australian system as more students began enrolling. He says there were also more part-time students and others who may have been less likely to find full-time work after graduating.
So what that's done is that's pushed down the average wage that someone would earn when they start repaying. So what you have is you have lots of cohorts of students coming out with loans that under the old system, the old threshold, Australia believed, policymakers believe, well, they'll all begin repaying eventually. They'll all earn above that threshold. And they're not now.
Delisle says he also thinks Australia is still struggling to find the balance between accessibility and affordability for higher ed. So no magic bullet there, but there are maybe components of Australia's system we heard about, that threshold for repayment, having to earn above a certain amount before you have to start repaying, or then the percentage your payment rises as your income rises. So, Professor Zodi, do you see any potential there or any possibilities for those ideas to work here in the United States?
Yeah, I mean, so basically you wouldn't pay over the first some number of dollars in income, and then you'd pay a bit more as you earn more, and it would increase as your income rises still. And it sounds kind of like a progressive marginal income tax, which would actually be another way of funding it as well. We could just do it through taxes and have it be free at the point of service. And ultimately, it's a similar outcome, except that it would, you'd only be taxing, I guess, people who went to college as opposed to everybody. But yeah, I mean, I think a progressive kind of income-based payment scheme that's just simple and easy would make a lot of sense. You know, I think a big difference here and why we're talking about cancellation is that so much changed, you know, so their policies are based on how things changed administratively and with college tuition in 1989, and it's specific to that nation's context. And here, what we've seen is that over the past 15 years, student loan debt has ballooned, it has tripled in the aggregate. So all of these people graduating with all of this debt, had they graduated 20 years earlier, would have been in a totally different environment and wouldn't be dealing with this debt. So that's also kind of an aspect that we're going to have to grapple with, the fact that something happened here and we've given a generation a lot more debt than any other generations or any ever had. Maybe we should deal with that. And to the extent that we're still going to have debt-financed educations, something like a progressive income tax makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Beth Akers, you wanted to respond there?
Yeah, you know, I'm a big fan of what Australia has done. And I want to point out that it's not entirely dissimilar from what we already have in the income-based repayment programs that all borrowers are currently eligible for. The difference is that that's the primary repayment system, whereas in the United States, you need to know that this program exists and opt into it in order to get the benefit, which is really the wrong way of designing it. This is essentially the progressive way of subsidizing higher education and that's financed through personal debt. And that is largely what we have as an option, which is why any programs of a more universal nature layered on top of that tend to be somewhat regressive.
Mm. So so I'm clear on something, you're saying that the remedy for people having to opt in now to these programs would be that everyone's automatically enrolled in them.
Yeah, that would be an option. It would take legislation, which we know is going to be difficult right now. But we could make it so that these repayments are collected through the IRS, and the amount that someone pays depends only on how much they've earned. Below an income threshold, they wouldn't have to pay anything at all. And then we'd make it much more seamless for people to repay these debts.
Okay. I can't help myself. Your observation of legislation would be difficult right now gets my award for understatement of the year. But I just want to listen to a little bit of what one of the most potent champions of student loan debt cancellation has had to say. This is Senator Bernie Sanders pointing to Wall Street as a place to help fund plans for student loan forgiveness.
10 years ago, because of their greed and illegal behavior, Wall Street banks were on the verge of collapse. And the United States Congress, with taxpayer assistance, came to their aid. Well, now we got millions and millions of families in this country who are struggling with outrageous levels of student debt. And maybe instead of just worrying about Wall Street, we start worrying about those families and that generation and give them a break.
Senator Bernie Sanders there. Now, you know, underlying this whole conversation, and Professor Zodi, you pointed this out explicitly, is the fact that what has happened is that the cost of higher education has skyrocketed, far outpacing inflation by, you know, multifold for many, many years. And if students are trying to go to school, those are the costs that they're having to deal with, which is actually why I see the political debate around debt cancellation right now. To me, I see it as kind of a balance sheet solution, not a structural solution. So I wanted to, when I say balance sheet, I mean balance sheet for one generation, one group, 1 year even. But this is what one On Point listener told us she thinks about the idea of loan forgiveness, that it's just the first step of the process.
I think debt forgiveness is just the first step. We really need actual reform, like lower interest rates, especially for graduate student loans, addressing the debilitating arithmetic of interest capitalization, and reducing the cost of getting an education in the first place.
So I wanted to spend the last few minutes of the conversation with both of you on this. How do we start getting a handle on that ever-inflating cost of higher education? I mean, some people have pointed out, and Beth, I'll start with you here, some people have pointed out that it's those the very existence of those federal student loans, sometimes at very low interest rates, that have caused this skyrocketing.
Yeah, exactly. We've sort of told people that in order to have the American dream now, you have to also have a bachelor's degree. And then we said, okay, here's all this cheap credit so that you can go out and get it. So, you know, it seems very likely, even though it's difficult to measure this relationship, that some of what we've seen of the increase in debt is simply that we've allowed people and given them access to this debt. You know, I'll say something that's unpopular, which I guess a lot of things I say are unpopular, but this one especially, I'm less concerned about the rising or the current cost of college than most people. What I say is that, you know, if you get in and through and finish your degree, for the most part, these degrees pay dividends over the course of your career. You end up with more money in the long run than if you hadn't paid for the degree in the first place. That's a good thing.
So just I'm going to let you say the other half of your unpopular statement here in a second, but I just want to underscore something. So you're pointing to the studies that show that overall lifetime income with a college degree is higher than without.
Right. So you'll earn for a bachelor's degree approximately $1 million more over the course of your lifetime, even after you take into account having to pay your debt and pay for the tuition up front. So what I like to highlight is that it's not so much the cost that's the problem, because if that return is there, you're good, right? The problem is that it's risky and not everybody gets that return. Something that I'd like to see happen is that we take the grant eligibility that students have over the course of their college career. They get some in their freshman, sophomore, junior, senior year, and let's pack it more towards the front so that people can experiment with college. And if it doesn't work for them, they're not going to have to walk away with that unaffordable $5,000 student debt. Instead, they can walk away with having experienced college, but without having something that's going to last for them for 10 or 20 years, depending on their industry of employment.
Mm. Professor Zodi, let me turn to you. Do you have a response to that idea?
So it's true. Getting a degree is a really important step in being able to secure employment and, you know, the kind of employment that's going to get you able to live kind of a solid life, economically speaking. Whether or not it must cost so much money and so much more each year than it did in the previous year, I guess, is where we disagree. I don't think it's a positive aspect of society for higher education to cost too much for people. And if we just give them the grants at the beginning and then the cost almost like a subprime mortgage with ballooning payments later, I'm not sure that that's good either, because what we need is for people to get in, to get through, to graduate and to be able to contribute to society afterwards. So, you know, if we could find a way to replace a lot of our current loans with grants or with interest-free loans. You know, in Australia, for example, they have this, you know, repayment structure, but they also have interest that's actually equal to the rate of inflation. So only about 2%, where in the US they're 5, 6, 7% student loan interest rates. So, you know, I mean, grants or close to grants throughout the enrollment period, I think would be the best way. Mm.
Beth Akers, let me turn back to you on something on your unpopular view that it's okay for the cost of college to continue to rise. I do challenge that. I do. Because, mm-hmm. because there has to be an inflection point after which the return on that investment starts going down. You can't have that decoupling between inflation is just the easy metric and the median college tuition continue unabated. Because
you're exactly right.
We literally started by hearing On Point listeners who called us and said, I don't even know if I can have kids because I have to pay my student loan every month and it's eating into a massive part of my income. I mean, that's the kind of existential decision making that a lot of people are undergoing. Can I buy a house? Can I even have kids? Will I be able to save for retirement? I mean, that doesn't seem like a healthy ROI on a college degree.
Right. So the reason that degrees are worth it in the financial sense is that people with degrees make more money than people without degrees. That has held up over time, even as the price has increased to what it is today. Going forward, I don't think that's a sustainable trend. You're right. So, you know, we do need to get more discipline into the market for higher education and somehow get these prices under control.
Okay. So in the last couple of minutes that we have, I just said, okay, like, yay, you agreed with me. But no, I mean, I just think it's such a huge deal. I mean, people are extremely burdened by this. But, you know, as we've talked about, there's in finding the right solution, there is a question of fairness. I haven't even mentioned the moral hazard issue. Do you think debt cancellation, Beth, brings up the potential of a moral hazard?
This is what I'm worried about more than the fairness issue. You know, you look at people who say, well, I paid for college and I didn't get this forgiven. What I'm concerned about is students tomorrow who say, well, hey, if they're probably going to forgive my loans next year, I'm going to go to the most expensive college I can get into. And then we really have a problem with ballooning student loan debt. So it definitely creates a misalignment of incentives for both institutions who might want to charge higher prices and students who previously had a reason to be savvy about how to spend on college, but no longer have that.
Mm. Well, Professor Zodi, we've just got about a minute and a half left here. To settle back down into the political reality that no matter which one of these solutions we discuss ends up, or if it ends up being reality, it has to go through legislation and policy making in Washington. So where do you see the most energy? What's most likely to happen, if anything?
I think that it's likely going to be just perhaps through executive action, a cancellation of some dollar amount, some tens of thousands likely. I mean, we're talking 10 to 50,000, I think is going to be a likely action. You know, and I wanted to touch on something that Dr. Akers had mentioned earlier about families who are really struggling. You know, there is widespread food insecurity, housing insecurity. Millions of households are in rental arrears right now and on the brink of eviction. And we need to give direct financial assistance to households in poverty. And that is a totally separate question from whether or not we're going to cancel student debts. You know, we have so many different fronts to make movements on. The good thing about student loan debt, though, is that it can happen through executive action. And so it can provide like a real relief and an economic stimulus as we settle the whole, how are we going to get legislation passed?
Well, yeah. So with that, Naomi Zodi, assistant professor at the City University of New York School of Public Health. Professor Zodi, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Beth Akers, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and co-author of Game of Loans, The Rhetoric and Reality of Student Debt. Excuse me. Not a Freudian slip there. Student debt. Beth Akers, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me today.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.